Chelsea Manning and others, Hope and Utopia, and how Trump, not by his own design, may actually assist in helping us deal with climate change. Interesting twist there. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Locus Focus with Barbara Bernstein, William DeBuys describes his journey in search of the sola, the first large land mammal discovered in 50 years. At 11, Disability Awareness welcomes activist Lisa Lake to discuss disability issues with houseless people and solutions for service providers. And at 11:30 on Voices for the Animals, we speak with legendary consumer advocate and author Ralph Nader about his new book, Animal Envy. Thank you, KBOO members, for bringing us all of this wonderful programming and for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. It's 8:59.
Tune in the fourth Monday of each month at 11:30 a.m. to Voices for the Animals.
We discuss the latest news and trends in the animal world.
And the role of activism surrounding the issues of animal rights.
That's Voices for the Animals at 11:30 a.m. on the fourth Monday of each month on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 34th Annual Real Music Film Series taking place January 13th through February 5th at the Northwest Film Center. New works and classics are featured this year, including The Jazz Loft According to W. Eugene Smith, Mose Allison, Ever Since I Stole the Blues, How Sweet the Sound, The Blind Boys of Alabama, the Les Blank film about Leon Russell called A Poem is a Naked Person, and many, many more. Again, that's the 34th Annual Real Music Film Series taking place January 13th through February 5th. All screenings take place in the Witzel Auditorium in the Portland Art Museum, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Well, folks, we are moles in the ground, and that mountain we're rooting down has gotten even more ominous and threatening. But we've dispatched many other lunatics in the past. So we are now 3 days into Trumpism. It's revealing itself as a friend of the most lunatic of conservatives, the most predatory of industries and companies, and maybe more alarming, a very dangerous, unbalanced man living in his own semi-paranoid reality. But thinking about Trumpism, I wonder, surely it's possible that maybe 25, 50 years from now, historians and pundits and all of us will be marveling about Trump's great positive contributions to stopping global warming. You might say ridiculous, very ridiculous. How could Trumpism possibly have positive impacts to save the planet? Well, here's how. Imagine a business-as-usual Hillary Clinton presidency. She would do as her Democratic predecessors have done, like Obama, like her husband, like Jimmy Carter. Like them, she would movingly commit to stop climate change, but really take only ineffectual action. And like all her predecessors, she would try her hardest to stimulate the economy, which, of course, means constant increase in greenhouse gas emissions. She has to stimulate the economy to keep employment up and just keep getting elected. Trumpism will be different. He will not make any ringing announcements on his commitment to stop climate change or bring on more renewable energy. He keeps announcing he wants to support fossil fuels and burn, baby, burn. In fact, he will likely be so repellent, though I hope short of starting a nuclear war, that all the environmental organizations and many cities and states will band together. They're already doing it, watching time fly, watching the risk of climate cataclysm keep growing, they will be forced by the people to actually develop and implement plans to very rapidly reduce greenhouse gas emissions. That must happen in this city. Surely it has to. And to hear more about how this could actually happen, stay tuned to this old mole show. Near the end, I will show how plausible it is and how this city could lead the way. Today on The Mole, I'm Bill Resnick, your host. I talked to Nancy Holmstra, a writer and activist, on the Great Women's March in Washington, D.C., also the march here in Portland. Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker are legal moles, talk about Obama's commutations, like of Chelsea Manning. Today, Clayton Morgridge does a well-read read on hope and ideas of utopia, both necessary to nurture. And I return to discuss how Trumpism, surely not by design, could be remembered as contributing to stopping global warming. That is, if our movements meet their responsibilities. First on the mole, though, a song, Frank Sinatra, I'll Do It My Way, which the Donald chose from his first presidential dance with Melania at the inaugural ball. Nancy Sinatra found that disgusting, as we will hear.
And now the end is near, and so I face the final curtain. My friend, I'll say it clear, I'll state my case, of which I'm certain. I've lived a life that's full, I traveled each and every highway and more, much more than this. I did it my way.
Yes, folks, Frank Sinatra's signature song, I'll Do It My Way, which always seemed to me a kind of nice, sweet period piece celebrating individualism, creating yourself, taking risks, appropriate for a time, the early 1970s, when people were really breaking free of repressive conventions as to sexuality and creativity and politics and dress and mandatory patriotism. But then Donald Trump played the whole song for the inaugural celebratory dance. And as he presented them and as he identified with them, the many verses really became putrid and ominous. Like, let me just state one of them. Yes, there were times, I'm sure you knew, when I bit off more than I could chew, says Donald. But through it all, when there was doubt, I ate it out and spit it out. I faced it all and I stood tall and did it my way. Well, when Frank's daughter Nancy heard Trump had appropriated my way, she was appalled. She tweeted Donald, her father would never have played at his inauguration. Another daughter said that Frank came to loathe the song, that he always thought the song was self-serving and self-indulgent. He didn't like it. That song stuck and he couldn't get it off his shoe. But it really does express one of Trump's many vile delusions. Next on The Old Mole, I'm Bill Resnick, your host today. I talked to Nancy Holmstrom on the Women's March in Washington. Also, some observations on the huge rally in March here in Portland. So here's Nancy. Hi, Nancy Holmstrom. Welcome to KABU.
Thank you. Hi, Bill.
Nancy Holmstrom is a philosopher, taught at Rutgers for many years, also an activist within the feminist, labor, and environmental movements. She's written a lot, including two books, The Socialist Feminist Project, The Contemporary Reader, and Theory and Politics. She also wrote half of the book, Capitalism For and Against. Nancy critiqued capitalism and spoke for socialism, that other better possible world. Ann Codd was the co-author. She spoke for capitalism. It's conversational. Also among her many articles, A Marxist Theory of Women's Nature. Nancy, along with a lot of other people, 500,000, probably more, you marched in our nation's capital this weekend. We'll be talking about the march, how it felt, its spirit, its content, its message. But first, let me ask you, you are just one soul in that 500,000, probably more, protesting the Trump presidency, proposing a very different system. But you could have stayed home. It would only be one person less. And you could have read and written stuff that might even have some impact, at least on readers. So why did you go? Why did you go to the march?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Personally, I just like to be with other people who are committed to the same thing that Aristotle calls like animal spirits, you know, that sense of community, that sense of sharing, to know that you're nice, not alone. That's very, very important to me. I also just like to express my views, give my opinion publicly as much as I can. That gives me satisfaction. And I think that people are committed to doing collective things, not just to do things that are for us individually. I believe that we're moved by feelings of solidarity and group identity and commitment to principles. And even for those theorists who believe that we only do things for individual benefit, they allow that when there are positive trade-offs, pluses for people, that adds to their likelihood to do it. So when you go and you see friends and you hear music and you hear inspiring speeches, those are further motivating for us.
I have to say that to some extent, I do it out of sort of guilt about letting other people do the hard work and me sort of getting the benefit of it, that is, fighting for a better world. It's part of left culture, it seems to me, to not exploit other people and to really participate in the work of the society.
Yes, I think that when you're part of anything, it could be a team, a sports team, it could be a choir, but left culture especially, maybe you're involved in the organizing part of it. Sometimes you are. And then you really, really, really want it to work and you want people to show up and you feel angry and disappointed if they don't. And when I haven't been part of organizing something, if it's something I believe in, then at least I feel obliged to show up, you know, to reward their work, to be there with them. I sometimes think I do this to a fault. I feel guilty if I don't show up for all kinds of things. I know the experience of looking out on two empty room, you know, so I want to be there for people.
Yeah, I know you feel badly for the organizers. It's good to see people, though, too, and to feel that. It seems to me it's characteristic of the left who really want to support others as well. This is KBOO Radio, Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Nancy Holmstrom, who is a engaged, active philosopher. She's written a whole lot of books. You can look her up, Holmstrom, Nancy, and find some of them, including her defense of socialism and offense for socialism in the book Capitalism For and Against. Nancy, let's discuss the spirit of the march, the messages, ideas. Did we say anything to Trump? What did we say to ourselves? How did you assess it?
Well, I was actually quite thrilled. I mean, I'm getting old by now, and I have been to demonstrations in Washington since I was in high school, including Martin Luther King's, the March on Washington in 1963, and on and on and on. And this was one of the most inspiring. I mean, I might make various criticisms of certain things, but for one thing, I think it may be the largest demonstration that I have ever been to in Washington. The big anti-Vietnam War demonstrations started to approach 500,000. You never know the official estimate, but this was way more. You could tell how really big it was, and considering the main demographic they're reaching out to is half the population, women, then it's even more remarkable how many people came. And the spirit was very positive, very much in solidarity, very much sharing what we have in common. I mean, I think that the speakers and the marchers represented quite a range of politics. And people spoke their politics pretty much, I think. But the emphasis was what we had in common as women. And the men who were there, I would guess there were maybe 20, 25% men. they were there as allies. There was a very nice sign which said, real men are allies, not all lies. There was one young couple. They both had the back of their shirts spray painted, and her said, my body, my choice, and his said, her body, her choice. So that was nice. So it was extraordinary, the numbers and the solidarity and the humor. Most of the signs, I would say, were hand-done. People must have gotten some ideas in maybe from the website before or something, because what I first thought was unique turned out to be repeated a few times. But still, they were done by hand, you know. It really was a grassroots effort of people from all over, all ages. There were a lot of people who were my age. Some women my age carried signs which said something like, I can't believe I'm still having to struggle for this. Sadly, they had to have that explained to them. But they were very gutsy, and it was beautiful, really.
You know, we had a march in Portland, which was also enormous, something like 100,000 people. You really couldn't get close to it. The mile long by maybe 100 yards wide along the river was just filled with people. In fact, people were still coming, at least from my position. The streets were clogged, but I mean, with enormous numbers of people still coming to the march that was already had exceeded anybody's expectations. And we had a feeder march, a labor feeder march. Labor feeder march was, it seems to me, in some ways somewhat disappointing, but also in some ways it had a wider range of messages. And my sense of the march was that even though it's very clear that to deal with Trumpism and to bring a society that, of both justice, environmental justice as well, there has to be a very large number of groups with particular interests working with so many other groups and developing a common sort of set of themes. And my sense was that the labor march was a little bit better on that question, that there was a sense of reaching down towards working class people and poor people of color and domestic workers, low-paid workers. But the big march, it seems to me, the emphasis was not that. It was much more of a what is called bourgeois feminism, but a feminism of equal opportunity and versus a feminism of not just equality, but of much higher rewards from the society for the people, for so many people who do very poorly remunerated, either in honor or money work. How did you feel about that?
Oh, well, I agree with you. To be honest, many months ago when I first heard that the only big march that was planned for Washington was a women's march, I thought, oh, God, it's going to be all Hillary supporters and, you know, whining about why she didn't win and why all women didn't vote for her, et cetera. And I wasn't enthusiastic. But then as it developed, I changed my views. It was clear that you could bring in all kinds of other issues. I mean, they had different contingents, or at least this was intended until it got just too big. Women in climate, there was a labor, you know, just all kinds of organizations were participating. Plus, I don't know exactly how the planning started, but in the end, the co-chairs, the national co-chairs, were very diverse and much more radical than Hillary. Hillary was mentioned a couple of times to an enthusiastic response, and Obama got even more enthusiastic response. But there were young women. A young black woman named Tamika Mallory was one of the national co-chairs. She spoke very strongly. She said, a lot of what you're experiencing now, we've always experienced. Carmen Perez, educational director of a Gathering for Justice, a nonprofit that Harry Belafonte started, works on juvenile justice, criminal justice. Linda Saussure, a Muslim American activist who actually, when she spoke, she introduced something about she marches for her mother, her daughters, and her grandmother, who's in the occupied territories. Interestingly, I think that the people who spoke were more diverse, that is, probably a minority, white women, whereas the marchers were overwhelmingly white. So I think that the politics was very inclusive. I mean, I could make some criticisms, particularly on economic and ecological issues, but it definitely included issues of racial justice, criminal justice, pro-immigrant. Had this adorable little girl, Sophie Cruz, and her parents spoke for immigrants. And several of the speakers, mostly but not exclusively women of color, spoke about the need for support for women to be able to make reproductive choices, which clearly went beyond just legalized abortion. So, as I said, I have some criticisms, but if you look at the guiding vision and definition of principles for the Women's March, it's pretty damn good. I mean, it's quite a bit better than we would have found 30 years ago, 40 years ago, which, you know, was when I started getting involved. It was much narrower, and it was for legal change, of course, which we didn't have. But then it got broadened, you know, through black feminists and socialist feminists. And I think this is a mix of the two. I think it's not perfect from my point of view, but it is a way ahead. I really am going beyond your question, but I think this is the beginning of a new women's movement. And like the earlier women's movement, it's going to be very mixed. I mean, you have liberals involved, even women on the stage. Liberal, I mean, I cringed at seeing Deborah Wasserman Schultz up there next to Kamala Harris, who spoke very well, and other black elected officials. And so it's going to be very mixed. I mean, you have ruling class women who are involved in this. There was an article in the Times about women on Wall Street who were going down. I know, heard of someone saying that they first had to, you know, they were going to be in Davos and then they were going to come right back and go to Washington. So it's a huge variety. But what else would you expect? So we who have a broader vision of the social change that needs to happen, we have to be there and push for that. But I think so many younger women are open to it after Black Lives Matter, after the Bernie Sanders campaign. I think that a lot of them will be receptive to our message.
This is KABU Radio, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for The Old Mole. I'm talking to Nancy Holmstrom, a writer and activist, taught philosophy at one point. Look for her books on the internet, Holmstrom. She was at the march in Washington, actually, for a couple days, the preceding march as well. We're talking about the spirit, the messages of the march. Nancy is very positive about it, that it was perhaps leading to a new stage of feminism where issues of social structure and class are much more important. And Nancy, democracy and real democracy is real important. Not, what I mean by real democracy is participatory society, where people are actually engaged in all sorts of ways in both making decisions and, in fact, creating that society, rather than seeing democracy as just a system of elections every now and then for people nominated by one or another big political party, highly influenced by business interests. It's a very different vision. Did you get a sense of whether that alternative form of democracy that you wrote about it in your book, Capitalism For and Against, was it present, and in what ways?
Well, I'm not sure I did, really. When Gloria Steinem spoke, she used the term deep democracy. That was nice. It's some of the signs. I mean, they were more personal. They were more personal or women-based, some of them very humorous and sexual.
Well, the personal is political, actually. When people are demanding voice and power and the right, in fact, to engage, participating, and making decisions in their organizations, in their work life, and in their family. The top-down family, of course, is still alive in America, that vision. Trump surely is a representative of patriarchy. It seems to me that democratic spirit really was there, and although not articulate and not in terms of there in the family and in sexuality a lot more than it was in thinking about the work and big social decision-making.
Yes, no, I absolutely agree. It has to start with your own feeling that I have a right to control my destiny. And for women, that has to include reproductive rights. If you can't control your body, you can't control anything in society. Legal rights just don't matter much if you don't have the right to control the ability to control your reproduction. So I think that's really core. And then the idea that you should have a right to control decisions that are being made that affect you, like whether you can get clean air, I think you're absolutely right. But I didn't see so much explicit attention to the social issues of, you know, of self-determination. There are all kinds of grassroots group, community organizing, and as so many speakers said, this isn't going to end. We have to go back home and be active and build alternatives and struggle and on like that. So I think it certainly was not just purely individual.
Nancy, I know that at the next Great March you'll be there as well, and a lot of the small marches.
Yes.
I remember in New York City going to marches with 30 people for Palestinian rights. It's now 300 people for Palestinian rights. And thanks a lot, Nancy Holmstrom, for talking to us today.
Okay, thank you, Bill.
Right.
Bye-bye.
So long.
These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days, these boots are gonna walk all over you.
Well, that was Nancy Sinatra. Her boots are made for walking, and they're good for making sure that you're heard. You may have noted a gap in the interview. Nancy Holmstrom referred to what Donald Trump, to his discussion of how to deal with women, a slang word for genitals, for grabbing genitals. We were forced to, the FCC doesn't want us to use the word. It's gotten very much attention recently, and Trump's fascination. Anyway, Nancy Sinatra's early feminist songs, These Shoes Are Made for Walking, it got a lot of plays last week when the Donald appropriated her father's song, I'll Do It My Way. As the controversy about Trump's choice swirled, Nancy Sinatra tweeted Trump a great line from the Federalist Papers written by Samuel Adams. The tweet was, "If ever the time should come when vain and aspiring men shall possess the highest seats in government, our country will stand in need of its experienced patriots to prevent its ruin." Welcome to our listeners, you experienced patriots. Right on, Nancy Sinatra. This is your Old Mole Hour on KABU. Coming up, a reading on utopia and hope. Also, a commentary on why Trump might actually play a role in stopping climate change. I'll give you a hint. It's because he will be so repellent on environmental issues that many cities and states will have to take things into their own hands and really do something, like Portland. Next on The Mole, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker discuss commutation, like of Chelsea Manning and the politics around it.
Mike, are you with us this morning?
I'm with you, definitely.
Yeah, you're in Mexico working and across the border. Thanks for being with us. We'll perhaps have another report on your work in the south of the border later. But today we're talking about the Obama's commutations. during his last week
it
in office.
The last burst of good news.
Right. Hundreds of sentences, bringing his total to 1,715 commutations over his 8 years in office. That number is less impressive in the context of the 20,000 others whose petitions were either denied or not processed. On pardons as well, where a crime is fully forgiven, Obama has been even more conservative. He's pardoned 212 people out of nearly 3,400 applications, less than most presidents in the last several decades. So lest we join the grief over our wonderfully progressive president leaving, which, of course, once again, in the context of what is happening, is truly grievous. Let's talk about those commutations and what they mean for both the lives of some of the famous political prisoners released, as well as their supporters and activists working on their behalf. Puerto Rican activist Oscar Lopez Rivera and whistleblower Chelsea Manning, of course, have been the most notable political prisoners released. What do you think is important about those commutations?
Well, the Chelsea Manning was really important because she did spectacular work. What she leaked were thousands of individual field reports from the Iraq and Afghan wars that gave us a close picture of two flailing efforts that have been stumbling around. And these reports were generally pretty honest. And the most dramatic, of course, for me, was the filmed effort of the casual brutality of people high above randomly shooting people moving around on the ground who turned out to be civilians. It's put a face to the fact that war is hell, war brutalizes people. We sort of know that abstractly, but that vivid picture that was unforgettable, and it's had much to do with shaping our view of that war. And she also released some 250,000 diplomatic cables, which were incredibly informative about the goings-on of U.S. statecraft. They showed Washington lobbying to keep the minimum wage down in Haiti, the poorest country anywhere. The entrails of imperialism are revealed in those diplomatic cables. And they've been used by everybody. There's no scholar, no newspaper now who writes about America's foreign policy who doesn't rely to some extent on what she made available to us.
You know, Angela Davis has written a lot about the whole category political prisoner, how in this country where the special category political prisoners is not officially acknowledged, she says, the political prisoner inevitably stands trial for a specific criminal offense, not for a political act. That's a quote from her. And she's also challenged that the whole meaning of what it means to be a political prisoner, as well as talking about the ambivalence of the state in this country toward political prisoners. Is this an expression of Obama's ambivalence, or what is the signal that he released Chelsea Manning, particularly given the outrage about it and all of the case against her mounted by the state?
Well, they treated her like the most vile prisoner imaginable. The army had her in unspeakably bad conditions. They'd punish her for using an outdated toothpaste.
In one of the federal prisons.
Yeah. And in Leavenworth, a prison reserved strictly for men. So that was really surprising to me that he would do that, but she got various support from transgender people, from even some, you know, right-wingers, as Julian Assange has become the bête noire of the Democrats after having been the poster boy of evil for the Republicans back when he was releasing materials damaging to what they wanted to do. So she's been adopted, and it's gotten more political support recently, but it was still a big surprise given the deep state's loathing of what she did, and how much exposing of the actual workings of America she did. But Oscar Lopez is a more classic political prisoner, like the Haymarket criminals in 1870 in Chicago on May Day. He was sentenced to, under seditious conspiracy laws, for bombings that no one denies he was not present at, but he had, for his writings about bombings, about what methods needed to be followed in order to attain independence for Puerto Rico. So his release was greatly, there were tremendous numbers of people in Puerto Rico and in this country who had picked up his case. It was less of a surprise to me that Obama would, in light of Lynn Miranda and other prominent celebrities' attachment to it, that he would actually commute his sentence, but it's long overdue.
There was quite a
bit of actually committing the crime.
There was quite a bit of disappointment that Leonard Peltier, the Native American activist who was convicted of murder in 1975 after two FBI agents were killed in the shootout on a reservation in South Dakota, you know, there's been a campaign for his release for decades. And how do you assess the denial of his petition?
Well,
particularly given that there's so much now with Native American
FBI's resistance, and that the FBI in this case was they're dead set against his release, and God knows there's, as you noted earlier, there's thousands of worthy people who are not released. But I'm going to enjoy here one last moment of pleasure at an executive act, since I'm not likely to have any similar feelings over the next several years. But he released hundreds of people who had been subject to hyper-punishment, who I think, and I think Angela Davis would too, are political prisoners. People sentenced to life terms for nonviolent drug offenses. The disparity between crack cocaine and regular cocaine, I think, is widely known. He moved to remedy that to some considerable extent. He didn't do much more than other presidents have on pardons, but he did spectacularly well on commuting excessive sentences.
You're saying not just high-profile cases.
Right. I mean, just lots of people. He actually went to a federal prison in Oklahoma and talked to some of these people, which no president has ever done before. And he knew many of these cases pretty well, and people close to him, of course, knew them much better. But lowering the sentences of 330 people on one day is a great way to say goodbye.
And so you're saying that those are moments that are important to acknowledge and celebrate, and what that means for not only the prisoners themselves, but for those people who've worked on their behalf for so long.
Yeah, there were tremendous numbers of people working for each of these individuals. They had to have some support. He did invite people to apply. You're right, he had a far greater number of applicants than were accepted. But that was at the behest of the White House. Make your case, he said, and lots of people did. In the course of doing that, even if you lost, there was, you know, energy and activity around each of these thousands of people.
Okay, well, Mike Snedeker, thanks for being joining us from your trip out of town today to talk about Obama's commutations. And we've got our work cut out for us here with our Left in the Law segments in the upcoming period.
Well, we do indeed. We are just beginning.
Okay.
We have to work very hard.
Okay, thanks so much. This is Jan Hawken talking today with Mike Snedeker about Obama's commutations during his last weeks in office.
We don't want your tiny hands anywhere near our underpants. We don't want your tiny hands anywhere near our underpants. We don't want your tiny hands anywhere near our underpants. We don't want your tiny hands.
Hi, folks. So that was only half of Fiona Apple's chant. The other half was a repeat of Donald Trump's famous delicate boast about grabbing their genitals. And she repeats that a couple times, and then does her first verse. Of course, that's only one of Trump's really absurd and obscene patriarchal and violent features, his inability to control himself. It's only one of his ugly features. Stay tuned on this Old Mole show for Donald Trump and climate change. Next on The Mole, though, Clayton Margaridge does a well-read read on hope and on ideas of utopia.
The demonstrations that occurred over the weekend and will go on occurring in response to the Trump regime are all about resistance. But a real resistance movement has to have an aim beyond and larger than just defending what we already have. If John Berger is right, then there is an aim already implicitly expressed by mass demonstrations. In the essay Norm Diamond presented on the Old Mole last week, Berger argued that a mass demonstration does not really aim to change what the rulers mean to do by appealing to their conscience. If they, the Trump gang in our case, had a conscience, the demonstration would not be necessary. And if the rulers do not have a conscience, they're not going to be intimidated by a bunch of unarmed people in the streets. A demonstration is really for the demonstrators, who, whether they know it or not, are rehearsing, preparing themselves for revolution. But what is the aim of the revolution? What do we want besides the negation of what already is? 2 weeks ago on this show, I tried to sketch a vision of a better society built around the question, how would we live if money did not exist? This was meant as an invitation to what might be called the utopian imagination. In defense of utopian thinking, I want to read from Ruth Pott's essay in Red Pepper, titled Utopia, the Right to Dream. She begins with a quote from John Berger. The first step toward building an alternative world has to be a refusal of the world picture implanted in our minds. In the culture of globalization, as in hell, there is no glimpse of an elsewhere or an otherwise. The given is a prison. So as John Berger reminds us, the first step towards an alternative world is refusing to accept that what we have is the best we can do. Utopians have been dismissed as foolish and naive dreamers, but they are central to human flourishing. The belief that the world could be fairer and life better spurs us on and creates the space in which change is possible. In the modern world, a restrictive notion of progress has muffled our imagination with harmful consequences for all of us. Utopian dreams are a catalyst for the oppressed and the marginalized. They remind us that other worlds are possible and give us the hope which, in the words of the author and activist Rebecca Solnit, makes action possible. Utopia is immediate and polemical, a prompt to dream and to act. It affects immediate changes in the real world now. Recent thinking in anthropology suggests that it was the development of our imaginations, and then consequently our ability to construct social structures and institutions, that allowed complex societies to evolve. Large societies and the glue that holds them together are all made up. Nations, tribes, religion, money, and the law-enforcing powers of a judge are arbitrary products of our collective creative thought. There are times when the arbitrariness of those systems becomes apparent. Perhaps we are now developing an awareness of the imaginary nature of the institutions we live in. Thomas More's Utopia, first published 500 years ago this December, provides a timely reminder of the enduring power of imagination and its ability to shape the world we live in. More's Utopia followed a well-known trope. The traveler who recounts their experience of a land in which a range of problems have been solved. It's a format that exists or has existed in every culture in some form. What Moore did was not new, but by naming his imaginary world, he gave the concept form, shape, and an irresistible ambiguity, meaning both no place and good place, the word utopia. And that has captured the human imagination ever since. Rereading Utopia today, what is striking is just how contemporary it feels. From concerns over access to land, to the corruption of an out-of-touch elite, and the unscrupulous behavior of kings in starting aggressive wars and dishonestly raising money, it is striking how the conspiracy of the wealthy endures. In Utopia, Moore attacks the irrational barbarity of capital punishment for theft. For the traveler who tells of life on the island of Utopia, the only way to reduce the number of thieves is to reduce the number of people who must steal or face starvation. By contrast, Moore offers an alternative vision of European society rooted in the humanist tradition. On the island of Utopia, there is no private property. Houses are allocated by lot, and people move home every 10 years. The doors of the houses swing open so that people may come and go as they please. Gardens are shared, meals are communal, and age is respected. The working day lasts just 6 hours, which is enough to provide for everyone's needs. Time after meals is spent reading or making music. There are public lectures every morning, and manual labor is valued. Society is equal, and gold and silver have no more respect than their intrinsic value deserves, which is obviously far less than that of iron, Utopia points out. Utopia has increased in popularity in times of great flux. Publications of Utopia increased around the time of the French Revolution, and again at the turn of the 20th century. Alternative visions are really ways that we embarrass the present, making the familiar seem strange and revealing possibility. Because Utopia is located elsewhere, it could be argued that utopian visions are necessarily disempowering. The utopian world is always just beyond reach and unattainable. But what if that is its point? In the words of the Argentinian filmmaker Fernando Birri, Utopia is on the horizon. Every step I take towards her, she takes a step back, and the horizon runs 10 steps further away. So what purpose does Utopia serve then? Well, it serves the purpose of making us move forward. To take those steps toward Utopia, we also need to recognize and celebrate the fragments of Utopia that are all around us, the myriads of ways people are organizing together to create a better, more humane world. Utopia is the expression of the desire for a better way of being or living. It is a quest for wholeness, for being at home in the world. All this means that we can, and we must, be bolder in imagining how the world could be. There is rich territory for us to occupy with bigger, brighter, more confident vision. I've been reading Ruth Pott's article, Utopia, the Right to Dream, from the current issue of Red Pepper, which is devoted to the topic Utopia Now, Where to Find Hope. We'll link to it on the webpage for today's show. I'm Clayton Morgeridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Well, the world seems spent, and the president
has no good idea who the masses are.
I'm one of them, and I'm among friends.
We're trying to see beyond the fences in our own backyard.
I've seen the kingdoms blow like ashes in the winds of change.
Yeah, but the power of truth is the fuel for the flame.
So the darker the ages get,
folks. That was the Indigo Girls, Let It Be Me, like getting a little help from our friends. Coming up on KBOO today, this morning, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. 10:15, Locus Focus with Barbara Bernstein, a journey in search of the Solu, the first large land animal discovered in 50 years, what that means. At 11, Disability Awareness presents Health Action 2017 and reports on Mamouya Abu-Jamal's a recent court victory to gain health treatment, as well as the ongoing struggle to make the U.S. government clean up naval bombing contamination. At 11:30, Voices for Animals speaks with Ralph Nader about his new book, Animal Envy. We'd like to thank you. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can donate. You can become one by going to KBOO FM and clicking on Donate. Next on The Mole, Trumpism and Global Warming. It's my commentary with the provocative title, Might Trump Be Remembered as the President Who Stopped Global Warming? How's that for being counterintuitive, or at least for the left? In the introduction to the show, I speculated that, who knows, maybe in years to come, Donald John Trump might be remembered as having a big role in not just stopping global warming, but also building the economic and environmental foundations of an eco-democratic world. Oh, ridiculous, ridiculous, you might say. How could Trump, this know-nothing climate change denier, possibly have a positive impact? Well, here's why. Imagine a business-as-usual Hillary Clinton presidency. Like Obama and all her Democratic Party predecessors, she would make ringing pronouncements about the danger of global warming and her commitment to stop climate change. But in fact, at best, taking ineffectual steps in that direction. Indeed, more than that, like her predecessor presidents, she would do all she can to keep the economy, the world economy, is very fragile, slowing down all across the world now, to keep it all going, to stimulate the economy, to get investors to invest more, to build more, for people to buy more, travel more, eat more, and without any pause, junk and throw away more, more, more. And in the process of trying to keep people employed and the party reelected, and remain popular, the country would spew out more and more greenhouse gas emissions. And yet still, of course, though greenhouse gas emissions kept going up, the big environmental and climate change organizations would support her as they've supported her predecessors and be happy they could announce some small gains. As for the big cities and progressive states, they would also defer to Clinton, hoping she will do enough. And after all, the federal government has all the money. No state or city can do it all. And that's what they would, of course, tell themselves. Well, that will not be the case anymore. Trumpism will be different. He will not make any ringing announcements on his commitment to stop climate change or bring on more renewable energy. In fact, he loves fossil fuels and wants to burn, baby, burn. And the more the better, the higher the smokestack, and the more smoke, it's more production, more goods, more everything. He will be so repellent and kick the environmental organizations and progressive mayors and governors, kick them in the face, that all the environmental organizations in many cities and states will band together. We're seeing it happening, maybe. Watching time fly and the risk of climate cataclysm grow, many cities and states will be forced by the people to actually develop plans to very rapidly reduce greenhouse gas emissions and then start implementing those plans, and thus build the foundations of an eco-democratic world. This might even happen in this city. Surely it should, with our great green reputation. In the near future, cities and states in the U.S. and most countries will be put to the test. Will they reason, compromise, avoid pitch battles with the Trump regime? Or will they take the reins and challenge Trumpism on its economic policies, on the kind of growth it envisions, and on its environmental death march? Also they will start planning to restore the health of ecosystems that are the foundations, of course, of planetary life. Governor Brown of California, Jerry Brown, recently declared war on Trump's climate change policy. Very strong statements. To be sure, many of the steps will be at best partial and inadequate. Even if California tries to build a more humane economy, which is also very important, they will not go to the root to challenge an economic system and accompanying top-down political system that cannot function without constant growth in production, consumption, and profit. As David Suzuki pointed out, exponential growth is the creed of the cancer cell. But no politician today can question the gospel of growth, that what humanity needs is more things, more profits, more prosperity, some jobs. Still, at the U.S. city and state levels and internationally across the planet, there will surely be efforts working together to forge ambitious, if inadequate, environmental policy, including major projects for reconstructing energy production, reconstructing transport, habitation, urban form, agriculture, and food production, in which process popular values and ways of life and fulfillments will also change. At minimum, these initiatives, done on cooperative and community scale but confederated across national boundaries, they could operate as and demonstrate the building blocks of an eco-democratic order. Surely we in Portland have to try. California has asked for allies to join them. We really should. Brown has taken a courageous step, Governor Brown of California, that must be supported, and Portland could offer strong support. Indeed, we are part of the way there. That's because Portland's climate action plan is seen as state-of-the-art, and surely is. It's the most comprehensive and well-written plan I've seen, and I've looked at quite a few of them now. The problem is that it's so timid about goals. Indeed, it really isn't a plan. It's a wish list, a statement of what the planners would like to do if they had the money. But their wish list is without real timelines for action. It's without cost estimates, much less where to get the resources. It's also without any responsibilities. How would this gigantic project operate without any assignment of responsibilities? How would this gigantic project operate? In fact, doing this planning, and quickly, has to be Portland's next step, to really develop a plan and identify the money. And that, of course, for Portland to do that will take great citizen action. It would take convincing the city council and county government and Metro to take global warming seriously and not betray California and the world. Really, Portland has an obligation to do that. But it would take a lot of organizing by us. More on that in coming weeks on the Old Mole. This was Bill Resnick for our Old Mole Variety Hour on KABU in Portland. Yes, we have to get active on all fronts, and we do have opportunities this coming week. Tonight, Monday, a No Child Behind Bars Living Resistance Tour from the U.S. to Palestine. That's this. It's tonight, 6:30 to 9 p.m. at the SAI Union Hall. The discussion will feature Ahad Tamimi, a Palestinian student speaking from her home in Nabi Saleh in the occupied West Bank, and Nadia Tanis, who has researched the detention of Palestinian minors since 2013. That's tonight, 6:30 at the SEIU Hall, 6401 Southeast Foster Road. On Wednesday, a picket for workers' justice at Burgerville. That's at 6:30 to 8 p.m. That's 1135 Northeast MLK Junior Boulevard. It's a Burgerville store between Burnside and Broadway as you go north on Martin Luther King Avenue. One of their organizers has been fired for lead organizer because he didn't, or his boss didn't pay for the 70-cent bagel that he ate, the boss suggested he eat. On Saturday, there's a march and rally for justice and equality, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. It starts at the Oregon Convention Center in front of the Martin Luther King statue. It then goes to a rally at the Maranatha Church. And there's going to be food and tabling there. It's hosted by the AMA, Coalition for Albina Ministerial Alliance, the Coalition for Justice and Police Reform, and others. Next on The Mole, we're going to conclude very quickly with a Sheryl Crow song.
You'll be all right. I'm on your side and we'll make it through. When you can't go on, I will be strong enough to carry you. Where the sun's gonna rise, when it's everything or nothing, and nothing seems all right, the sun's...
Okay, well, we truncated somewhat the Sheryl Crow song. It's called Rise Up. It assures you that you're among friends. We can shine our life like a light. And that's all. That's our final message for today's Old Mole Show. Thanks to Nancy Holmstrom for her report from the Great Women's March in Washington, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker for the discussion of the politics of commutation, Clayton Morgridge for reading on utopian radical hope, and also to our mole engineer, our great engineer, Joe Clement, who makes sure that things happen right. Thanks to all of you out there who support this station, since we live in... Since we live stream and archive everything, all 24 hours a day of programming, we get support from all over the planet, mostly from Portland. Hope you folks do meet your responsibilities. Finally, you can hear this show or any part of it again or any of our previous shows or recommend us to your friends. Tell them to go on the web to cable and go to the top right, the search box, type Old Mole or Old Mole Variety Hour. Today's show should be up very soon, by tomorrow, maybe even this afternoon. Join us again next week for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's Underground Perspective. I'm Bill Resnick, your host today, signing off.
Monday, February 13th at 6:30 p.m., Prison Pipeline will be hosting a Valentine's Day special. We will be reading your Valentine's shoutouts to your friends and loved ones. So whether you are locked up or your loved one is, we welcome you to mail or email us your Valentine's messages. Our address is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Attention, Prison Pipeline. An email is kboppc@gmail.com.